It's the White Cloud Truth About Markets.
That's right, Stacey Herbert. It is the Truth About Markets here on Resonance 104.4. Still in Paris, still enjoying the Parisian rentrée when everyone comes back from their summer holidays and catches up on all the bank failures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you notice that? Once everybody came back to Paris, the whole banking system finally started to collapse, as everybody over the summer was warning would happen, but it couldn't happen until the French were actually back in the city.
Yeah, nobody was here to liquidate the banks, but they all came back, and now they're organizing this massive Euro-wide TARP, Euro-TARP, with the help of Timothy Geithner, who is trained at the School of the Americas for financial terrorism. He's here helping Angela Merkel and Sarkozy organize a Euro-TARP.
Mangala, did you see we can't repeat it, but did you see about, who's that sleaze bag in Italy, Berlusconi? Did you see that he was caught on mic saying about Angela Merkel?
Yes, he made a disparaging remark about the leader of Europe now. Berlin and Germany, they are set to impose some discipline in this area.
Well, he said that she was so ugly and unstoopable, basically, but in the swear word. So here's this guy. He's like 89 years old, right? But why does he need to just constantly think this? And why are these people dancing like this?
They're making a home video of young dancers here in the park, and they're clearly underage.
I think it's a Tamil Tiger.
This is a Tamil Tiger recruitment video. If you go and perform our deeds for us, these are the virgins awaiting you in the afterlife.
The person laughing in the background is Richard Bluestein. He's a new member of the Parisian expat community living here in Paris, editing the Kaiser Report, I hear.
Again, I have nothing in common with Madge Weinstein, who you keep talking about.
Weinstein look a lot alike. I thought you were related because, you are both Jewish. I thought you might be related.
Not all Jews are related.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought that was the thing. They're supposed to be related and look alike.
No, we just own the banks.
Oh, that's the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Are you trying to tell me that that's true?
Yep, sure.
And don't you own the media?
Yeah, we own that. We own everything. Kill us again.
Oh, boy. See, now we're on the, is this the north or south side of the park? Oh, it's the south side of the park. We're not usually on the south side. Let's go sit on one of these benches and watch all the people.
I love watching the joggers. It's one of my favorite things to do after work.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. The only problem is it makes my laptop all dirty because they lift this dirt up with their feet.
That's right. You ever see Max jogging past?
Yes, I jog in this park occasionally, and I just dust up and get the dust, floating, like
when I was from people's laptops.
A lot of the laptops get destroyed.
So Max, the Bank of England is also essentially printing dollars. They're allowed to. There were all those alleged currency swaps. U.S. Central banks swapped dollars with all these. The European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and one other central bank, the Swiss National Bank. So Mervyn King's printing dollars this weekend, lending out unlimited amounts of dollars to the British banks. Apparently the British taxpayers, though, are on the hook if anything goes wrong with these loans.
Well, yes, this is financial oppression, isn't it? They have to keep printing dollars, because of course dollar is the unit of enslavement that has kept the globe enslaved for decades, and they must keep printing dollars if they want to keep interest rates at zero, the zero interest rate policy, otherwise known as ZIRP. They must keep it at zero to finance the resecuritization. For example, all of the bonds in Europe have to be resecuritized again, and all of the bonds, the sovereign debt in the UK has to be resecuritized again and extended. And of course, this means that interest rates must be kept at zero. So two outcomes are now inevitable. Number one, you're going to have increased impoverishment of anyone living on a fixed income or a pension account. And number two, more social unrest. As Mayor Bloomberg in New York City said this past week, he expects Cairo-like social unrest in New York City due to zero interest rate policies and financial oppression and the suicide weapons of mass financial destruction wielding terrorists on Wall Street. This is all coming to ever greater levels of chaos.
Well, do you think this Mayor Bloomberg's statement that he expects Tahrir Square-style violence in New York, do you expect that was just a psyops against the planned Occupy Wall Street this weekend? Do you think he was just trying to turn middle-class people with their mortgages against any sort of resistance? What do you think?
I would think it would be the opposite. I don't really understand why he would do that. I mean, I would think if he wants to avoid people, not call attention to the protest, he wouldn't mention it.
Well, he didn't mention the the protest exactly,
but still, I mean, I would think if he says that's going to be Tahrir Square, that would excite people, make them want to protest. But then again, I don't really know.
Yeah, but you know, the Mubarak and Bashar Assad in Syria, they say the same sort of thing, is that these are terrorists and, you know, hooligans and violent people out there.
But isn't Bloomberg saying, you know, this is that result of bad policy? Isn't that what he's saying?
He's saying because people are poor and unemployed, yeah, and not working.
It doesn't sound like he's saying these are terrorists if he's saying that. It sounds like he's saying, look, you know, you better fix this before my people here in the city go ballistic.
Well, from the New York Post headline, it seemed more threatening that this was a dangerous thing happening. It, like, be afraid of these sort of people. What did you think, Max?
To Rabbi Schechter, he didn't see anything.
Rabbi Schechter? What did Rabbi Schechter say?
Rabbi Schechter said it wasn't a big deal because nobody called him. Nobody called him.
Rabbi Schechter is on today's On the Edge.
He felt neglected. Nobody called him for the protest, so therefore it will not be a success.
The Ribby Schechter. This is my Ribby. Ribby Schechter is my rabbi. I go to Ribby Schechter whenever I need to work out some intricate moral question there's King Solomon isn't available, so I go to Danny Schechter.
And his wife makes mean potato latkes, too, I heard.
Yeah.
I think he's a Bronx boy, you know.
Probably. Listen, the thing I wanted to know about this money printing.
Yeah.
So any bank in the world can print this money if we say so? Is it like the Bank of England is actually printing this money physically?
They gave them the plates for dollars, and they're just spinning them like hotcakes, rolling off the press.
So can I get one of these printers at Fnac?
Yes, of course. Anyone can print up dollars now. Do it at home. It's good for the economy. It's good for your health. Anyone can print dollars. That's what America is saying. That's what America is all about. Print, print, print.
That's a good idea, actually. That might rescue the economy. No, it's five banks. It's the U.S. Fed, the Bank of England, the Swiss National Bank, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan.
And they physically print our money.
No. Very few physical dollars are ever made these days. It's loans. They issue overnight or three-month loans to banks. So J.P. Morgan could go, or like Royal Bank of Scotland here in the U.K., could go to the Bank of England and swap alleged collateral for a U.S. dollar loan. And this is because all these fraudulent debts are written in U.S. dollars.
Wow, that's nice. That's really good.
Yeah, so it's they need to expand the pool of dollars because you've got $600 or $700 trillion in derivatives that are all priced in dollars. And to keep those moving through the system, if the system dries up, if the ready dollar availability evaporates, they have to keep printing more dollars to keep the machine rolling. Even though the machine doesn't produce any jobs or GDP or wealth of any consequence, all it does is create commissions and create bonuses for the people in the banking industry. And, of course, that's why this has become a very dangerous situation for anyone who's got a savings account or hopes to work for a wage to support themselves. And this is why you have rising social unrest in these countries all over the world, because these people are being squeezed out of society, basically. They're being, like, I think it's a good comparison to say, you know, that it's like the Indians 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. They were simply forced onto reservations, and they were scapegoated, and they were basically just left to rot. And this is what's happening in cities and towns all over the world. And the people are rising up. Now, when Bloomberg says he thinks this is happening in New York City, well, yeah, of course, except, you know, there is a part of New York City which is the Gilded Cage part of New York City, which includes the top 0.1% who live in a fantasy land, you know, a Gucci-esque Disney world of ever more printed dollars. You know, they're the first ones to get the printed money. They get to use it first to buy luxury goods. And then the theory is it trickles down to the rest of society. But since the bond market hit the, you know, top of its move, a 25-year bull market recently, there's no trickling down anymore. Mortgages, the housing market is continuing to collapse, and the situation is becoming dire.
You know, of course, I believe this liquidity, this flood of U.S. dollar loans to the market via five central banks, it was really a rescue of the French banks, and that was very certain. You could have seen that when, remember, an unnamed Bank Paribas executive was quoted just a day or two before this announcement that it was impossible for them to get any U.S. dollar loans. They were shut out of the markets. And the very next day, there was this big announcement, a sudden shock announcement of unlimited amounts of U.S. dollars, no cap on how much U.S. dollars was available to these banks. So I think they just did it. You know, they say it's for the Bank of Japan, Swiss National Bank, and Bank of England as well, in order to, you know, prevent the crisis from being concentrated in France. But I think it was the French banks.
Right. Well, I mean, you look at the valuations of the French banks, like BNP or Société Générale, they're, what, $10, $20, $25 billion? Mm. They have balance sheets that are $500 to $600 billion or more. J.P. Morgan is worth maybe $30 or $40 billion, the stock. They've got a balance sheet with $9 trillion worth of derivatives there. So how is that possible that such a small little foundation can support these huge derivatives and debts? And the way that they say that they can do it is that all the counterparties are good and that all of this stuff is perfectly matched in the derivative markets and that no one's really taking any risk. But that's the classic argument for the Ponzi schemer. You know, they say, well, everyone who's getting their current income, it's guaranteed because we've got plenty of suckers coming in to feed the Ponzi scheme. Well, that's just not happening anymore. And so they are, to accommodate this pyramid that can't be accommodated, they're changing laws. So there's, you know, Basel III, for example, is an international law that governs minimum bank requirements. What did Jamie Dimon say last week? If you force J.P. Morgan to comply with Basel III, you're being anti-American. So he's playing the terrorist card to get away from having enough capital on their balance sheet to service his debts.
What does that mean, anti-American? Anti-fake money? Anti-theft? I don't even understand what that means, anti-American. They throw these terms around. It's just, all it does is, I don't know, make them
well, it doesn't work
sense.
As well. You know, there's the best one is the anti-Semitic, if you say anything about Israel, which is so weird.
Which I find really offensive because it downplays what real anti-Semitism is. It's really offensive.
I hate that too, and it just shuts down conversation. Yeah. Same thing here, to say anti-American. It just shuts down the conversation.
Yeah, well, it's just a... what do they call it? Speaking of Israel and the Jewish tradition, a shibboleth. Shibboleth?
Rabbi Schechter.
I'm going to ask Rabbi Schechter about this. But it's like a code word. You know, it's a... It's just a symbolic of anything else. It just triggers a response without any thought whatsoever. You know, it's... I think it comes from some Jewish tradition of when the gatherings of Jews, they had like passwords or code words. I could be completely wrong about this. But anyway, so it becomes a, you know, in the U.S. politics, if you listen to the Republican debates, for example, they speak in code.
Yeah.
You know, they speak in words that trigger emotional responses, but there's absolutely no intellectual firepower behind it whatsoever. And so this is the same now in the financial markets. They say it's anti-American. What does this mean? It means that people get a hard on to go out and shoot people. You know, for no reason is what it means.
You know, I think another buzzword that I hear a lot to stop conversations, particularly in Republican debates, job killer, job creator. All the time, they talk about like a tax on rich people is a job killer. And it hurts the job creators, but they don't create jobs.
Well, we're in their world that they've created, the elite. They frame the debate anyway. So here in the UK, they're talking about this 50% tax rate, and it's being driven by what bankers think of it. And the reason why we even have an income tax is because of bankers. If it weren't for them, we would not have an income tax on any of us. So, but they're the ones that act like victims of the income tax, that it's somehow socialist attack against them, when it was they who used the income tax to take money from us.
Well, I'm going to use my Fnac money printer, and I'm going to use it to pay for hookers, and I think that'll help redistribute money. What do you think?
Well, there's the hooker index in Latvia, which there is an update on this that came out last week. The prices for hookers in Latvia is trending down or staying sideways. It indicates that the financial recovery there is not really gaining much traction. So you can still get a hooker for, so it's a buyer's market for prostitutes in Latvia. And you know, if you're into that Northern European tang, you can get a good deal on some hoochie-hoochie.
Have you ever been to Latvia? Latvia has the most beautiful people I've ever seen. I really believe that.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. So your dollar goes far if you're looking for a lap dance in Latvia.
I really like their cafe. They have this cafe culture where the cafes are right on the busy walking paths. And it's everything's crotch level. So when you sit, you have your coffee or your, you know, drink or whatever, you see nonstop barrage of Latvian crotches and tight pants, which I think is nice.
Well, I have a theory about why your Northern Europeans and Europeans tend to, you know, that reputation for beautiful women in particular. It's because the conquering heroes kill all the ugly women.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And, you know, after war, hundreds and hundreds of years of war, you know, the conquerors, they kill the ugly women, and they keep the beautiful women, and they breed, and they get more beautiful. In the U.S., you don't have that kind of wholesale war for hundreds of years, so they tend to be kind of blah.
No, you have large Mexican women wearing Big Macs on their thighs.
Big Macs on their thighs?
Yes, that's the one thing I don't miss. Well, there's many things I don't miss. But coming to France, that was one of my first thoughts. Where are these women with their pink shirts with the little picture of a teddy bear on it with that's just lift, you know, letting their fat hang out? Like, you see, this is normal to see tight spandex with disgusting. You can just see the Big Macs. You see that it is McDonald's food there. And the love handles just oozing out fat, lumpy McDonald's fat. It looks just like the hamburger. I mean,
speaking of McDonald's and fat, did you see that story last week about people who are going to cryonically freeze their fat? That so that when they get older and they need fat injections to smooth out their wrinkles, they're going to tap their own fat bank. And this is a growing business.
Well,
that's good.
Speaking of health and bankers, there's a story that I just saw on nakedcapitalism.com that apparently has received absolutely zero mainstream media attention, no media attention at all. It was their press release was published in Market Watch and the Boston Herald, but it's nurses. There were protests across the U.S. this past week of nurses protesting, demanding a financial transaction tax. Again, Max, tell us about this financial transaction tax, and bankers will say, again, it's socialism, and you're trying to thwart capitalism. So tell us about this.
Or, as Richard was saying, it's a jobs killer.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one that they like to throw around, which is something we can continue talking about.
Never
because
people killing.
Yeah, it's if you dissect this jobs killer meme you find out that it's absurd and ridiculous. But this this nurses' protest, I'm not exactly sure why the nurses got into the financial transaction tax, how they came to that conclusion. But I'm curious to find out more. But the transaction tax itself, I guess you could say, goes back to the Tobin tax. Tobin is an economist who proposed that there is a 1% financial transaction tax as a way to fund parts of the economy that are not getting funded. And it would raise a tremendous amount of money. I like to make the comparison when I do my stand-up rage act in cities around the world. I have a prop that I use, which is a placard that I found on the table of one of the private clubs in London that I've been going to for a number of years. And the placard says, "We charge £1 on all of your meals that goes to feeding the homeless." Now, I've been going to this club for years and years, and I've looked at that placard, and I've never actually read it. I finally looked at it. And for years and years, I've been deducted £1 per meal that's been going to the homeless, and I never noticed it. I never thought about it. I never gave it a second thought. Similarly, if 1% transaction costs were charged to bankers and speculators and brokers and derivatives dealers, not a single one of them would know the difference. That's point number one.
Wouldn't they just put it back and charge it to us, the end user? Because I already get like all these transaction costs. Anytime I make a transaction here in Europe, it costs me at least a dollar.
Are you engaged in high-frequency trading?
No.
Well, there's the nature of the business would change to accommodate this extra fee, but the money would be raised. The dealers would not notice it at all. Now, would they simply print up the commensurate number of dollars to overcome the fee, which would be inflationary? Yeah, I suppose so, but that's a quality problem. You know, that's a problem that, you know, once you have this thing cash flowing in the right direction, you can deal with in a constructive way. But the point is that these people who are in this business would not notice this fee whatsoever. I think Jeffrey Sachs is also a proponent of the transaction fee. And the reason I bring up his name is because he's going to be the big name economist attending the Kilkenomics Economics and Comedy Festival coming up in Kilkenny, Ireland in November, in the first week of November, which I will be a part of this year.
Is he a Rebbe as well? The Rebbe Sachs.
Is he Jeffrey Sachs? I'm not sure if it's Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs. I'm not exactly sure.
There's also going to be Austin Goolsbee.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's a rabbi.
I don't think so.
Maybe a priest. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, we're all going to be there, the three of us, and we're going to be in the Kilkenomics Festival.
I can't wait. I've never even been to the to United Kingdom. I've never. And it's
this is Ireland. This is air.
Isn't it the same thing?
No.
Oh, boy.
Oh,
we just lost half our audience.
Listen, they need to have something to tweet about, okay?
No. Northern Ireland, yes, that's part of the United Kingdom.
Oh, what's the difference?
This is the free people of the South.
We need to get over those religious quarrels from those years ago. It's just ridiculous. Killing yourself about killing each other over religion is just stupid.
It's happening all over the world.
No, that's true. I'm sorry.
Well, I was talking to David McWilliams about this actually on our newest show, and I asked him whether or not the split in Irish society now between the people who are getting the money from NAMA and other institutions that are there to deal with the financial banking crisis and everybody else who's not on the payroll of this corruption. Is it a new division similar to the ancient Catholic Protestant divisions that have torn the country asunder? And he kind of sidestepped that question a little bit. He didn't want to get into rehashing again, you know, the Irish troubles, as it were. But I believe that there does seem to be a new kind of class war going on between the folks that are on the tit of the bailout stream, that are people associated with NAMA, etc., who are just recycling all this fiat money and paying themselves outrageous salaries, even though it's killing the economy and killing the housing market and creating immigration now is rising again. Housing market looks like it's, according to David McWilliams, will be bad for another 5 years. And the IMF's little oppressive programs are kicking in a big way. So it seems to me that there is another. And I noticed that the Sinn Féin now has a candidate for running in the next election. So this could be an historic election where Sinn Féin ends up, I guess they're running for president or prime minister, I forget.
Oh, in Ireland,
yeah.
Not Northern Ireland? Well, it's Teat, Max. It's not Tit.
Yeah, Teat and the Teat. I think it's the president or prime minister. I forget the exact office in Ireland. But Sinn Féin is, and I believe that Sinn Féin, you know, after the Fianna Fáil disaster of the last 60 years, I mean, why not give Sinn Féin the ball and see what they can do? They can't do any worse.
Can I explain why I've never been to the UK?
Yes, explain to us. Is it the drunkenness?
No, it's the tax. Because anytime, like when I fly to Europe, I use air miles that I've earned in the U.S. flying around to do dumb shit. Oops, damn it!
You're always swearing. What is
I did
it
so
with
good so far.
The Bluesteins and Weinsteins of
no,
the world?
Not related. It's just Jews. And so, oops.
Okay, well, so it's the airport tax.
Yeah. So every time I fly to Europe, it's using a free ticket, but you still have to pay taxes. If I fly to Brussels, the tax is like $50. If I fly to France, it was like $5 to fly here. But to go to England, even through England, it's like $195 each way.
Well, there's a thing called the Eurostar, you know. You can go from Brussels. It's only an hour and a half or 2 hours from here.
Just to go to gosh dang England. Yeah, that's worth my trouble.
Yeah, again, remember, I had to tell this to your fellow co-religionist, Madge Weinstein. You can murder all the people you want, tens of millions of them across the Middle East.
Yeah.
You can loot and steal people's oil
and
all that kind of stuff, but you cannot swear in this country.
I understand. I will never do it again. I swear to God.
Yeah, exactly. And Stacey said, what happened?
We're in Paris. You can't swear to God in public. You know, as of Friday, it's against the law to pray in public.
Stop it.
No, as of yesterday, it's against the law here to pray in public. So do not swear to God in public.
Okay, I'm going
to
look up a Facebook comment that somebody wrote to me that's funny, but go ahead.
Okay.
I'll find it eventually.
What about this praying thing? Does it mean like the prostration on the sidewalk type of prayer or just any kind of prayer?
It means we're French, we're cranky, and we're going to blank with you.
Yeah. Well, it's election season coming up here as well. So apparently it makes the population very happy if you diss some Muslims.
Speaking of elections and Muslims, there's an election coming up in Tunisia. Stacey Herbert, tell the people.
Yes. Our friend is on the ticket, the top of the ticket for the Progressive Democratic Party. His name is Monsef Sheikh Ruhu.
Oh, he's a sheikh.
Yeah. Well, he owns some sort of publishing company, Empire, in Tunisia that Ben Ali stole from him in 1999 and forced our friend Monsef out into exile. He's here in Paris. And I guess Ben Ali, when everything started to fall apart, he tried to sell this publishing empire to one of Gaddafi's sons. And so our friend Monsef was just back from Tunisia and won his publishing empire back from the courts against Gaddafi's son.
Gaddafi.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So he's a big wheel in the media business, and he said that there's a place for us in Tunisia as an advisor to the cabinet on financial affairs, which I'm excited about.
By the way, this man is your debate partner in the infamous Goldman Sachs sucks video.
Why is Tunisia important? I mean, as an American, I've barely even heard of the country.
Well, that's because it's not a colony of America. It's a colony of France. It was a colony of France.
Yeah.
And Italy has a lot of, connections in that area. But it's mostly a French occupation throughout northern Africa.
Is it somehow pivotal in global politics right now? Or?
Well, it was the first to start the Arab uprisings.
Oh,
you know,
that's right.
The fruit and veg seller guy burned himself.
Right.
And then, did you see, actually, speaking of that somebody in Athens yesterday lit themselves on fire in front of a bank saying that they were so much in debt? And it was pretty...
That'll help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's right. They lived. The police came and they put the fire out. And so, yeah, Athens is still very much on the front line of this financial war.
Shouldn't the bankers do that, too? They're pretty much more in debt than anyone, right?
That was in the olden days when, you know, the mafia used to have a code of honor. And these mafia guys, they would find, you know, they would blow up the world economy and they would jump out a window. And now they don't do it anymore. They think other people should be thrown out the window on their behalf.
Right. Can I show you this? This is the Facebook thing I was referring to. I took this nice picture of the Louvre thing, the arch there at the Louvre. There's all these arches at the Louvre. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I posted this nice picture. How could you say anything bad about that? Deborah Wilkerson writes, "Those people make me sick." Sin, and I wrote, "The French, why?" She says, "France has a long, bloody, and shameful history of persecuting anyone who doesn't bow down and kiss their A. Anyone who doesn't conform to the zeitgeist at any given time had better watch out. While embracing every sin imaginable, this filthy nation violently persecutes anyone who's not Catholic and is taken to imprisoning and fining those who dare to stand up and say that it's not okay to be a fag."
Well, you know, the truth is you do walk around the city, and how many plaques are on the sides of buildings saying 45 young children were deported to Auschwitz from this building? So,
yeah. Well, France has an interesting distinction during the Holocaust as being a country that went over quota in deportation of Jews to the concentration camps. Well, they really got into it. They decided that maybe this was a great idea, so they went over quota. But you see, if you walk through the, certainly during the historic Jewish quarters like the Marais, you see plaques on walls, and they say, "Here in 1940X, you know, 14 children were abducted by the state and sent to their death in concentration camps." And it's also on the Rue de Rosier, where you can get a fantastic falafel, by the way. They have the bullet holes of the Nazi occupation and ransacking of the quarter, which are still there and venerated by the locals, you know, as, you know, we should never forget, etc. So it's still very much a living history of what went on. And so, yeah, France has a history that is full of corruption. But I mean, I don't think you can say it's any better or worse than any other country. It's longer. That has a longer history. The U.S. history is very, very short. It's a newcomer on the world stage, and you know, there's no. I don't really see the U.S. really existing much longer in the same form that it was maybe 50 years ago or 100 years ago.
Yeah, but and the other thing about that comment is we were just watching Democracy Now! The other day, and most Americans have zero knowledge. They have never acknowledged the millions and millions of Latin American peasants slaughtered through the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way up into the 90s. They executed tens of thousands of peasants in Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador.
Through the death squads, through the local, supported their terrorists or whatever.
Yeah, through the military there. So in Guatemala, it looks like the new president will be one of the former death squad leaders who was trained at School of the Americas. And I guess from WikiLeaks cables that the administration in America wants this guy in, even despite his past. He's known to have slaughtered thousands and thousands of people.
So, you know, we're wrapping up in Iraq and Afghanistan if we're back to putting terrorists in South America again.
Obviously, there is some intention there that's happening. They're getting ready to reoccupy Latin America. They've gotten too uppity.
Yeah, no, they had a breather there, didn't they? A lot of people say that the Renaissance in Latin America, the U.S. took their eye off the ball in Iraq, and so you had Brazil and these other countries with naming two or three.
Venezuela, Honduras, the guy, you know, that was driven out of Honduras.
There's the other indigenous leader now.
Bolivia.
Bolivia, yeah, I'd like him
really
a lot.
Brazil's really been taking off. I mean, they're a huge...
Well, Brazil is one of the so-called BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, which is the new, you know, countries with huge reserves and resources that are the wave of the future.
There's other things that are huge in Brazil.
But, well, Brazil has those oil reserves that they found, but they're also very, very way too uppity, standing up to the U.S. and the U.N. and trying to negotiate a Palestinian-Israeli peace deal.
Oh, yeah.
And also, remember, they tried to negotiate nonviolent resolution to Libya. and America just overrode that. So you do notice that in the last few years, America started building some of their military bases around Brazil, surrounding Brazil now. So you could see that that's going to be the next, in the future, that will be a sort of Libya-like state that will, the population of America will all unanimously decide that we must kill these evil people.
The problem is Ipanema's gotten too expensive for the rich people to go vacation to, so they have to bring the prices down. I think that's what it comes down to. It's just too expensive. The handbags are getting more expensive there. Used to be such a bargain.
Well, the Brazilians are buying up all of Florida.
Are they? Yeah.
Yeah, because of their very...
Florida's so cheap now.
The real.
The real is up 40-50% in the last year against the dollar.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, I have an interesting thought exercise because I read last week that the cost of the components for an iPhone are $3.50. And, of course, they sell these iPhones for, $150, $160 or so?
That's subsidized price. Like, unsubsidized is like $600, I think.
Okay, so the markup is enormous. Apple Computer, the biggest company in the world, bigger than Exxon, they've got something like $60 or $70 billion in cash on their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Now, my thought exercise is that if Apple manufactured in America, they could keep the price exactly where they are for the products. Instead of paying $3 per unit, it might cost $40 or $50 per unit, but they could eat through that huge cash reserve or develop more customers inside the America because they'd be creating jobs in America because most of their sales now are outside of America. So by simply relocating some manufacturing to America, you'd have manufacturing jobs, high-wage jobs, people, new customers to buy your products. You have a huge, enormous cash cushion that you could use to subsidize this. So Apple Computer, is an example of a company that's anti-American to me. Don't call me anti-American because I criticize, the country that my ancestors helped create and fought for. But I think Apple Computer is anti-American because they're clearly... Their agenda is at odds with the common interest of America.
You talked about on one of the shows about how Henry Ford had, one of the reasons he was successful is because he raised the price of what he paid the workers, and somebody asked him why, and he said, because who's going to buy the cars? That mentality is somehow lost now. It seems like a lot of just decent, just intelligent business sense is gone.
Okay, so we were talking about Apple and bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. Of course, the actual process of working on the factory floor, building things, is also an engine for innovation and knowledge.
That's the thing. The idea of giving workers enough money to buy the products is, capitalism. But you don't have capitalism in America anymore. You've got this kleptocracy and globalism, a global kleptocracy run by a few thousand people at the top of this enormous Ponzi scheme that is financed by phony money printing.
I don't understand a lot about economics because when these economists talk about, the fractional reserve and all this and leveraging the debt 300-1 and all this stuff, I kind of don't get it because it's so theoretical. But what makes sense to me, it's like, okay, so America has had all this money that really we didn't work for so many years while the Chinese were making all of our stuff. And now, it just seems to me it's only logical that the Chinese who've been working need their money.
Yeah.
So it's payback time. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And why Americans think it's somehow socialist to have a job.
Yeah. You had this enormous bull market that started in the 80s under Reagan. And under Clinton, it was given another 10 to 15 years of life with the inclusion of China into World Trade Organization. So now the deflationary effects of deregulation could be extended for 15 years because everyone started to outsource their labor to China. So the people in America had two benefits of this. Number one, the cost of stuff at Walmart went down. And number two, the Chinese, to stop inflation from their own country, bought a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds, which meant that interest rates were kept down, which meant that American housing market went up. You had the housing bubble. of the late 90s and 2000s, which was a direct result of this World Trade Organization, including inclusion of China. Now, starting in the year 2006, 2007, the housing market collapsed. So now people realize that the gains were illusory and that their interests were not being served. And now the prices at Walmart are going up because the people in China are starting to get higher wages because the RMB, their currency, is starting to appreciate against the dollar. And they're then going to be the middle class driving the global economy, not Americans. So Americans were seduced into believing that they were beneficiaries of this huge, you know, Bill Clinton engine. You know, Bill Clinton, he did this. He also passed the NAFTA, which was a disaster for many reasons. He also brought in the new Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which gave banks the ability to leverage, you know, from 10 to 1 going to 50 to 1. And he also was oversight during the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So Clinton, in a lot of ways, was the perfect Republican candidate.
There's a piano being pushed through the park. I think that is.
I think there's a refrigerator, isn't it?
Oh, is it a refrigerator? It looked like it was curved like a grand piano there. But
it's one of those new piano refrigerators. It's it's shaped like a piano, but you can keep your... So you were fascinated by the Picard stores of frozen food, I understand.
Yeah, this is France, but there's these stores everywhere where there's nothing there. You just see... It looks like a coffin store. So you walk by, and there are all these people lifting up these coffins, looking at dead bodies. And I thought, what is this? And I realized they're food shopping. And in France, where I would think everything's fresh, and whenever I've been here before, there's markets everywhere, people buying fresh stuff, squeezing. And now, all of a sudden, on every block, there's this coffin store where you open things up, and it's frozen everything. I never went into one because they looked scary, and I figured I probably would do it wrong anyway and get scolded. But I don't understand what this is about.
Yeah, but isn't it... fresh vegetables and fruits and meats frozen. It's not like a processed food there, I don't think, right? I mean, Max, I think you've been to Picard.
Yeah. Well, it's it's a store that has only frozen food, right? So, and it's on these freezers, and it is odd looking. I myself found myself not wanting to go into one for a long, long time because you don't really know what the heck's going on here. And then, you know, you go in there and you realize the business model. So it's only frozen food. Now, it's very handy for fish and meat. So all of your fish and meat, you can get frozen if you want to stock up on this type of stuff, you know, fresh frozen. Plus, it's also good for fresh frozen, like grilled vegetables is a good one, a very popular item. Then they do prepared meals, which, you know, are not great because of their... They taste great, but you know these things are loaded with sodium and all kinds of stuff, so that's not great. But but this is also, I understand that they're going to open one in Los Angeles this year. And my friend of mine who lives in Los Angeles, he shops only at Picard, swears by it, loves their, you know, prepared meal of whatever it is he likes.
Friend also has an apartment here in Paris.
Yeah, he's got an apartment here. He's very small. You know, apartment, it's very convenient to do this. They give you, their shopping bags are like those ones that are insulated shopping bags because everything's frozen. I believe you pay a little extra if you bring your own, you know, back, your Picard insulated shopping sack. And but he swears by it. But they're supposed to be in L.A. soon.
When I have an itch, I pick hard.
Yeah. Well, that can be nasty if you don't have a salve to take care of the potential bacterial infection that comes from itching too hard.
I want to bring up a point about America, Return to America, because those Tea Party debates were held on CNN. And the one thing that got a lot of attention was when, was it Wolf Blitzer asked about whether or not Ron Paul would let this guy die.
It was Brian McWilliam, yeah. Brian Williams.
A 30-year-old guy who didn't buy health insurance because he thought he was healthy, and then he's in a coma.
Yeah. So, and the audience cheered when Ron Paul said, you should take care of yourself. And then Brian Williams responded, well, what do you mean? So you would just let this guy die? And a handful of guys in the audience were like, yeah! But remember, a lot of these Tea Party people, they're now have found out that they're actually evangelical, okay? It's just the same old group of people that were always there,
yeah,
evangelical.
And their welfare mama, too.
Whatever it started out as, and I believe there were other groups of Tea Party people in the first at the beginning of it. Yeah. But now it's just the evangelicals that are there. Now, it reminds me of 2005 during the Bush administration when these same exact people made a big, giant, you know, a political story about Terri Schiavo, who was in a coma. This woman was in a coma for about 20 years. Her brain had shrunk to the size of about a walnut.
Right. Mm.
And she was being kept alive only because of Medicare or Medicaid, because she was pronounced indigent.
Right.
Because her husband obviously couldn't afford to keep her in this she was living round the clock at healthcare.
Yeah.
But they were telling us that we, the American people, could not let this woman, die.
Right.
So what do you think about this whole sort of hypocrisy?
Well, my first thought was Richard's comment about the coffins at Picard and frozen vegetables. But putting that aside for a second.
Which is his freezer?
Yeah, well. Yeah, you know, that's I forgot what I was going to say.
So they're saying that a 30-year-old guy who was in a coma, they would let die, but a 30-year-old woman in a coma with no brain, she was being kept alive because she was white as well.
It's team sports. Nobody cares about people. The Democrats don't either. It's team sports. Well, I think Democrats kind of do actually, but I was raised Democrat liberal, so I haven't brainwashed, I guess, but except when it comes to black ones.
Well, I kind of thought Terri Schiavo we saw was a white woman.
Yeah.
And I think probably in their mind that they're thinking it's going to be those illegals and those Mexicans and those brown and black and those sort of people that will die on. If the guy, they were fictional 30-year-old man in a coma, I think they were thinking is not...
I don't know what they were thinking, because I would imagine that the people that said that probably don't have insurance themselves, but I think they're so into their team sports. And by the way, there was that plane crash yesterday at the Nevada.
Reno,
did you hear about this?
Show?
Yeah, the air show, which made me think... I mean, I felt bad that kids died in this, but at the same time, they have an air show every single year in Chicago in August, and it is the most vile, revolting thing. And every year I think to myself, oh, well, one of those planes crashed already.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I brought that up.
Yeah, I don't know what that's...
He's like one of these Tea Party guys here.
He's gone off on the tangent. But, you know, when I saw this response, Brian McWilliams on the show with the cheering of the execution... Right? Now, let's go back to what we were saying at the beginning of the show. Mayor Bloomberg is expecting civil unrest. There's civil unrest, social unrest all over the world. In Middle East countries like Saudi Arabia, they are raising the stipend that their population gets to keep them quiet. In other words, in the post-economic environment we're in now, the society, the mob, demands their little stipend, their food stamp, and public executions and violence. Now, 2,000 years ago, this came under the term bread and circuses as the Roman Empire declined. They keep the mob to appease the mob. They gave them their daily bread, and they did the incredibly violent spectacles in the Colosseum. And this is essentially the American Colosseum. They will violently, and I would think that the pace of executions will pick up. They'll start to broadcast them so people can participate them directly. As the point was made about this Texas execution, the last Texas execution going back to a public execution when the public was invited, they had something like 30 or 40,000 people came to the execution. So this is what we're heading for, stadium executions. 50,000 people show up to watch a few black guys get fried. But that's what you'll need to appease the mob.
Well, you know what? Actually, in one of these articles I was reading, it's only because of Medicare and Medicaid that hospitals in America, or certain hospitals, some private hospitals don't have to treat you in an emergency situation. But any hospital that accepts Medicare and Medicaid for any of their any patients in any of the wards, they have to accept everybody at the emergency room. So that's part of the reason why the Republicans want to get rid of Medicare and Medicaid, so that hospitals don't have to treat people that arrive in the emergency room, even if, you know, it's like a 7-year-old girl. If her family doesn't have insurance, sorry, girl, you're dead. Now, some people are arguing, well, like, what if you're just out in your sweatpants going to get something at the shop and you get hit by a car and you're in a coma, but they don't have any proof that you have insurance, they're going to just let you die.
Center. Yeah, that might. I worked in hospitals for a long time, and the thing is, even if, like, they do have those rules, pretty much, you know, if you're not, if you go to a hospital that's a private hospital and they don't accept Medicare, they will try, and unless it's extremely life-threatening, they will transfer you to another thing. But even if not, even if you're at a place that accepts Medicare and that will treat you, they're gonna make you go through hoops to try and find out if you have insurance, call your relatives. Meanwhile, you could be dying.
Yeah.
So they could still treat you, but it might be too late because you don't have insurance. It could just take an extra 5 minutes that could be used to save your life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, we have about 7 minutes left.
Can I mention one thing? This is, you know, the bubble. Okay, so you have all these economic bubbles. I really feel like we're in an economic bubble. Not an economic, a political bubble right now. Like, and it's, you know how bubbles, it's always really obvious to anybody with half a brain who isn't completely indoctrinated with all the propaganda, what do you call it, with the, you know, the psyops. And it's always really obvious that the bubble's going to burst. And to me, the bubble that's really obvious right now is political. Like, you have all the rich people taking the money from the poor people. It's really obvious. Everybody knows it. There's all this, you know, talk about job killing, all this. But the really few really rich people taking all the money directly from middle class and poor people, leaving this giant gap of people that are broke and completely, you know, just completely destroyed, basically. And what's obvious to me is that it's going to result in humongous amounts of violence. And the thing in England was like a sneak preview, like, okay, we're going to give you, just because in case you're so stupid that you don't see it, we're going to make a really obvious hint for you and show you all this civil unrest that will be happen on a, you know, a multiple of 1,000 if you don't do something about this right away. And meanwhile, they just blame it on the individuals. I'm sure many people in your audience are the same people that just say, oh, just a few evil people that are just doing this for fun, like, you know, like spiders.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Max, do you have final words on that?
Well, it's like if you watch the movie Titanic, you know, the rich people kept trying to get to the two or three staterooms that hadn't sunk yet, and the poor people were locked up in the steerage, and everybody sunk. A few people got off on boats, and I think, you know, this is one of the untalked about legacies of 9/11 is that. And the rich people in America realized the game was over, and they started to leave the country, financially speaking. And they just figured that whoever was left behind was going to sink and die anyway. This is the shock of what a lot of the wealthy in the United States and around the world kind of took that position. Like, well, democracy was great. It was fun while it lasted, but the barbarians have won. So we just need to protect our own. And everybody dresses this up as some kind of economic program, or Obama thinks that a stimulus package might do this or that, or taxing this or tweaking that program is going to have a change. But the fundamental underlying trend here is that the wealthiest of the wealthy are simply seceding from the economy. They're walking away and they're taking the ball.
They're taking the money.
Yeah. But also, you know, with that Titanic analogy is, I'm sure on the Titanic, the lower class in the steerage also felt, you know, we must protect the rich people and get them on the boats and save them and rescue them. And that seems to be what you see happening in America. And the Tea Party people are part of that. They, you know, they seem to be very corporatist and want to protect the Koch brothers and the Soroses of the world.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I see this all the time on the internet, the bots, the robots that kick in anytime a trend develops. We know this from Gmail. If you send a Gmail to a friend saying, oh, you know, Hawaii is great this time of year, suddenly the ads all around your Gmail account are about, you need a discount on a flight to Hawaii? Right? So it's all the computer and the robots are monitoring you algorithmically to market to you. And the Tea Party initially was a group of a political movement that attracted some attention, but it immediately got overtaken by algorithmic bot-wielding advertising and marketing people who put up a cutesy Barbie doll like a Sarah Palin and are making oodles and noodles on the marketing of this concept, and it becomes a marketing phenomenon, and the political component of it is long, long gone. And the half-life of a philosophy or a movement in America, which used to take, you know, rock and roll is a good example, something that it took 30 years before you know, the late 50s and the emergence of Chuck Berry and the radio free airplay and the cheapness of a vinyl 45 gave way to the corporatization of the 1980s and, you know, 50s, yeah. And then it became moot, didn't it? Bruce Springsteen is a big, you know, sellout. And rock and roll is, you know, died. And then, so similarly on any political movement now, but that the half-life of this takes, it doesn't take 30 years anymore. It takes about a week or 2 weeks before, because the algorithms are so powerful, yeah. The computers are so powerful. Any movement, any idea that gains traction within 2 or 3 weeks. And that's one of the things I like about our shows is that because we're outside of the mainstream, we have a very, very big global audience, but it's very shallow. So we have people in cities and towns all over the world, a few people, but it hasn't hit the critical mass where we're getting, you know, the doors being banged. Even though we have 3 million viewers for every one of our Kaiser Report shows, that's more than Conan O'Brien. But nobody is trying to get us, knock us up to sell some junk on our show because they don't hasn't showed up in their algorithms yet.
Well, with that was a very good way to end the show, and it feels like it's about to start raining, so we're going to head on.
I was hoping there would be a horse to poop at the end like last time, but
no, not today. We're in the wrong half of the park.
Maybe that man over there will.
Okay, well.
Bye, y'all.